Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of the Commercial Connection Podcast. I am your host, Spencer Taylor with Mill Creek Commercial. As always, great to have you here. Our guest today, Amanda Schmunk out of South Dakota, right?
South Dakota, yeah.
Remind me the city.
Sioux Falls,
Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Amanda knows how much I enjoy South Dakota, so we won't get into that. But Amanda is president of Homestead Escrow and Exchange, helping clients with their escrow and 1031 exchange needs. She is also the newly appointed president of the Federation of Exchange Accommodators, an organization that advocates for the continuance of 1031 exchanges. A lot of work, and maybe she can speak to this, maybe share a few sentences here, but a lot of work is done lobbying. A lot of work is done supporting QIs around the country, ethics, procedures, rules and reg updates, all that exciting stuff. Amanda, welcome.
Well, thank you, Spencer. I'm happy to be here. Yeah.
So great to have you here. It was great to see you last week at the annual conference of Federation of Exchange Accommodators.
Absolutely. Yeah. We all had a lot of fun out in Santa Fe, and it's always great to see everybody in person as much as we talk throughout the year with different clients and different QIs. It's nice to come together and not only be in a room full of people that understand 1031s, but continuing that education and getting updates, like you said, on some of the lobbying efforts and updates to the 1031 rules.
Yeah. So before we get into this, we're going to talk about how you care for your clients. We're also going to talk about the world of exchanges as it pertains to agriculture, ranchers, farmers, that sort of thing. But before we dive in, tell us a little bit about you, Amanda. What do you like to do? Tell us about your family. Tell us about your hobbies. I see a lot of books in the background. Have you read every single one of those books? They all look like law books.
They are mostly law books, which means I have not read them all. The top two shelves of books are all the South Dakota State Code.
Wow.
Which I specialize in 1031, so I don't use as much, but as a lawyer, I joke that I am a lawyer, but I am not my client's lawyer. We do keep up to date on as much of the code as we can.
Sure.
And then the bottom shelf that is visible is all 1031 books. So every year there's a new 1031 book that is released that has any updates, any new cases, any new revenue procedures as they've come out and how they update the code, how it updates, how we should do our processes.
Yeah.
And any changes throughout the 1031 industry. So we keep up to date with those as well. Both for our knowledge, but also with the ability to distribute that information to clients. So that's the books situation. I do have a lot of books at home as well, and have read most of the ones at least at home, but they're not as much legally books as they are fun books.
Yeah.
Like Spencer said, I'm in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I was born and raised in the northern Colorado area, growing up in Fort Collins and Estes Park. Came to South Dakota as a child, got all my formal education here. Went to South Dakota State for undergrad, graduating in 2015. Went to University of South Dakota for law school, graduating in 2018, which somehow is 5 years ago now. Which brings up, I've been at my company 5 years this Sunday. So I have been a QI since I graduated from law school. And Homestead Escrow and Exchange Company is the sole dedicated company in the state of South Dakota doing 1031s. So I'm happy to be the president of that organization. I am married to my college sweetheart, Joseph. We both live, like I said, here in Sioux Falls. He works for the city in city government. We've got a puppy that we are obsessed with. That is a 4-year-old blue tick coonhound. And as Spencer is well aware, we are expecting our first child. I just hit 9 months pregnant last week, or like 2 days ago. So we are about a month out from giving birth to our first child. We love to travel, which has been, other than the conference last week, on hold, and will be on hold for a while with the new one. But we love to travel. We love national parks. We love road trips. So we do a lot of driving, whether it's from South Dakota to Louisiana, Texas, California. We do a lot of driving and a lot of travel. And hopefully we'll get international as time continues to move on, and borders and international places seem to be as a little bit more comfortable and welcoming and things like that politically. But yeah, we love to travel. We love to eat good food. We love to cook. We just, yeah, have a happy little house and love our jobs, which is an amazing thing to be able to say.
Now, you said you went to San Diego. No, I'm sorry. You went to South Dakota State University, SDSU.
Yep.
So, funny story.
Okay.
I sold pest control in Southern California.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So, you know the other SDSU. Okay.
When I was there, I toured San Diego State University, and I got an SDSU sweatshirt.
Oh, it's kind of black and red, isn't it?
This one was brown and gold. For some reason, I don't know. They had a bunch of colors, and that's the color.
Yeah. Okay.
I was really into brown in my college days. Brown pants, fair. Brown shoes, whatever. So, and then I went to go knock doors and be politically active like almost every college student is. So we were assigned to South Dakota, right?
You're like, oh, I've been to SDSU, and everyone's like, and
so I was wearing my SDSU sweatshirt, and everyone would say, go Jackrabbits, right? Because that's
yeah, go Jacks, yeah.
And so I was like, don't understand,
right?
Store,
because I'm pretty sure San Diego State's like the arrows or something. Their little logos, like a little the back of an arrow. I don't know what they're actually.
But this just had SDSU on it, just the letters.
Yep.
So like the fifth time it happened, I'm like, why does everyone say that? Well, your shirt. Your sweatshirt. And I'm like, this is San Diego State.
It's California, Mike. Yeah.
Anyway.
So if you know it's from California, people here are going to be like, oh, we don't want you here anymore. Yeah.
So I'm really excited to dive in because I love this topic of caring for your clients, how important that is. So I want to pick your brain. How do you do that? How do you do that inside of the 1031 world? And then let's dive in and talk about agricultural exchanges and maybe differences and maybe similarities between an ag exchange and, you know, compare that to kind
traditional,
of
like
a duplex exchange or a fourplex exchange. So Amanda, how do you approach this idea of customer service, caring for your clients? What's your mindset? What do you try to do above and beyond?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we find really important in our office, that I guess has made us unique is that we don't want just every exchange to come in the office and we say yes and we move on. We, in that client interview process, want to make sure that an exchange is the best option and the best route for the client. Mm-hmm. So if they call in when we're asking, what are you selling? How long have you held it? What is your basis? Just so we can figure out and help you figure out your gain. We can't give you tax advice. We can't tell you exactly what your gain would be or exactly what your tax rate would be. But we can tell you on estimates what the exchange cost would be. And then what if your tax is somewhere in this realm, what your savings are. So you can see that ratio and you can see, oh, your taxes might be around $100,000, but you'd have to get that from your tax advisor. The exchange costs you X. You can see that value ratio.
Uh-huh.
Some cases, if you're selling a smaller building or a smaller house, you have less gain. Sometimes you've held it not as long. You don't have as much gain. So we can go, okay, in the fact that we want to make sure you're doing what's best for you, we look at that partial exchange. We look at how much are you buying? Are you deferring all of your capital gains? If you're not deferring all of your capital gains, what taxes are you going to have left? If the amount of tax you have is less than the cost of the amount of tax you're going to have to still spend is less than the cost of the exchange, it might make more sense for you to not do an exchange. And that means I don't get paid. And I'm okay with that because I want what's best for my client.
Yeah.
And I know that if at the end of the day, I do all of my client consultations as part of our services, but they're included, and they leave not doing an exchange, they're going to walk away knowing that they got the best advice that was for them or they got the best direction for them, but then consider us in the future or then tell their neighbor, hey, call Amanda. She'll at least be able to tell you if this is a good deal for you. And that will end up getting me more business than them paying me to do an exchange, them realizing come tax time. Either didn't save them any money or it wasn't worth it. And then they're going to tell everybody not to call me or tell everybody not to do an exchange because it's worthless. So we feel really strongly that we want to be the best person for them, even though we can't be their agent in their QI role. We want to make sure we're saving our clients money. And if there's a chance that we're not, we want them to know those numbers and know that they should maybe talk to their tax advisor about, is this important? And I've even had clients go as far as they're looking at $250,000 in taxes and the exchange doesn't make sense because of what they want to buy or what their replacement structure is, they've already got set up, and it doesn't really work with a 1031. So they could buy something else, and they could rent that out, and they could use that money to get a refi into paying off their new project. But they didn't really want to be landlords. They wanted to build a new building. They wanted to do something else. And so it might make sense to pay the $250,000 in taxes. And yeah. That sucks. And we hope that clients come to us in time that we don't have to say that that might be your best option. But like I said, I don't want you paying me and then realizing, oh, I'm either stuck in a position I don't want to be in, or halfway through the exchange, I'm not going to do my replacement because I want to do what I wanted to do initially. I'll just pay the taxes. Well, now you've paid the taxes and you paid me. And so in the element of caring for clients, we just really care about making sure that our clients are getting an experience that they not only enjoy and can turn around and go, hey, that was easier, that was simple, or Amanda did a great job explaining everything, but also they would tell others to come back and call us if they have questions, because we would rather, like you said, have people know and feel good about our services than know and feel bad about our services.
And you kind of hit on this point, those listening, consult your CPA. Your CPA is going to be the one closest to you, closest to the numbers, understanding what you've done over the last
to this 5 point, years. They're the ones that file your tax return. So at the end of the day, they're the ones that are going to tell you what your base is. Yeah. They're the ones that are going to tell you what your gain is. They can tell you what your tax would be, whether you do the exchange or not. And a lot of times when we get off of an initial phone call, that's the next person we say, okay, so the next person you need to reach out to is your tax advisor. And if that's your CPA or whoever that is, you need to talk to them about what, if you're doing a partial exchange, what your tax would be. If you're not doing an exchange, what your tax would be. If you do the exchange, but it's not a full exchange. So it's, we like I said earlier, I am a lawyer. I am not your lawyer. I am a tax accountant or tax lawyer. I am not your tax advisor. I don't file your tax return. If the IRS comes knocking, I'm not the one they're going to knock on the door of. It's going to be the person that filed your taxes.
Yeah.
So they need to be comfortable with it. And that even comes down to if there's a red flag on the exchange, whether that be a related party or a fair market value issue, we always tell people, make sure you go to your tax advisor, because at the end of the day, they're the ones filing your tax return. And if they're comfortable with it, that's their call. If they're not comfortable with it, that's their call. So you need to make sure you're aware of what your advisor is saying, because at the end of the day, you two are the ones that are going to be filing your return.
So you're bringing up a couple points, and I want to make sure we touch on these. You're talking about basis. Okay, so give us a 30,000 foot view. What is basis? How does it calculate? And I get a question a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, does the basis reset when you do a 1031 exchange? So kind of give us a high level
view of
that. Yeah.
Yeah, so your basis is whatever you paid for the property minus any depreciation that you've taken over the time you've owned it, plus any improvements that you've reported over the time that you've owned it. So if you bought a property for $500,000, you've depreciated it down to 300, but you've put 100 into it. So now its basis is $400,000. You're selling it for $600,000. You would have $200,000 of gain, $400,000 of basis.
Yeah.
In a 1031 exchange, for a full deferral, you have to buy $600,000 of replacement property, because that was your relinquished sales price. That's the property you sold is your relinquished property. It's got a sales price of 600. For full tax deferral, you have to replace it 600. If you replace it 500, you still have $100,000 of gain that you would pay tax on, because the IRS takes your basis first. So you have to buy at least the first 400 of that 6 to cover your basis. And then that 200, anything over 400, you chunk into your gain. And so that would be a partial exchange. If you buy 500, you'd pay the exchange fee to defer $100,000 on the gains, and then you would pay the tax on the other $100,000. If you buy, say, you're selling for $600, but your ideal replacement is only $350, you didn't cover your basis, so you didn't actually save any money. And that's where we, like I said, we talk about the client counseling element and caring for your client. Because if they say, we don't want to buy anything else, we want to use that, the rest of that money, to pay off something other than that we have, or to buy a personal residence, I say, okay, but you need to know then that you might not be actually saving any money on your exchange.
Yeah.
Say you go from 600 to 600, or 600 to a million, you go up in value. The way that works is that if you're going from 600,000 on your sale price, and you had a basis of 400, and you buy 600,000 on your replacement, your basis is still 400. if you go from 600,000 on your sales price of the property that you're selling, and you buy something for $1 million and you're going to finance the difference, your basis now is the 400 from your initial $600,000 plus the 400 you've just put in from that 600 to a million mark.
Mm-hmm.
So now you had $200,000 of gain you defer from your exchange into your replacement property, which means that the day one that you own your new replacement property, you already have $200,000 of built-in gain that if you ever decide to sell it, you would pay tax on. Because you are not eliminating the gain when you do a 1031, you are deferring the gain into whenever you sell it.
Yeah.
So that's how the deferral of basis works. That's what basis is. It's basically what you have into your property, how much skin you've got in the game. And then the difference on the sales price is your gain, and the gain is the portion that is taxed.
Yeah. Good. Anything else you want to kind of touch on as you and your office approaches kind of this caring for your clients aspect?
I would just say do what's our office idea and our office mentality is doing what's best for the client.
Yeah.
And so it's making sure they're aware of all the rules. It's making sure you've covered all your bases and asking the right questions of if you have a replacement property and they say, yeah, I've got one picked out. You don't just say, oh, okay, great, and move on. You say, okay, what is it? And is it owned by your sister? And it's like, there are things that you need to find out to make sure that this is a qualifying replacement property. How long do you intend to own it? What's your intent with the property? Things like that. So it's all about knowing the client and knowing their situation. And that's one of the things that as a smaller state and a smaller QI, we really take the time to make sure we're doing what's best for our clients and doing what's best for their interests in doing a 1031 exchange.
So an agricultural exchange, these are interesting. These are interesting. And I'm just going to kind of share a couple thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely.
On my observation on why I think they're interesting. Number one, there's not a whole lot of improvement on, let's say, a farm or a ranch, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's interesting. So to me, that's interesting. And I'm going to get into why in a little bit as we talk through this. There's also a lot of different investments that are on the property. So for example, cattle, right?
Yep.
That's like livestock. That's not, that is not real estate.
Correct. So it used to be exchangeable until 2017.
It used to be exchangeable. Yeah.
Yeah. And now ever since 2017, when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act came through and they changed the tax code, now it's investment real estate only. So yeah, the ag world was affected by that as much, if not more, than the traditional commercial world was on the 1031 front.
Now, do you have a lot of corn and alfalfa farmers?
We have a lot of corn. We have a lot of soybean.
Soybean, okay.
A lot of ranching, not like people growing ranch dressing. Yeah. It's one of the questions that we get.
So what's interesting about corn and alfalfa and soybean, before they're harvested, that corn is real.
It's part of the land. Yep.
But the cattle is not. Also,
correct.
Right? So
correct.
And then there's also a lot of farming equipment, just kind of the nature of the business.
Absolutely.
Farming equipment, not exchangeable.
Correct. And there's a lot of things that are on ag land.
Yeah.
Like farm buildings and irrigation equipment and things that would go with the land. You're not going to ever take the barn off of the land or the hog confinement. We have a lot of hogs up here. So the hog confinement buildings technically are not real estate.
Not real estate. They're
depreciated as personal property. Or technically, it's just, it's equipment in the eyes of the IRS.
Interesting.
And so when we go to sell that land, a lot of times in the 1031 realm, and part of the reason that I'm talking about this with Spencer today is just because I'm in South Dakota. So half of our state is very agricultural farming.
Yeah.
And the other half is all agricultural ranching.
Yeah.
And there's tiny little pockets of towns spattered across the way, half of which have like 10,000 people or less, if not 1,000 people or less. And so, very ag heavy. I'm in Sioux Falls, so we have a good portion of commercial and residential and things like that as well. But we do quite a bit of agricultural exchanging. And so things like ag equipment and things like that, we have to get really used to asking those questions. And they say, oh, it's just bare land. And we say, okay, on that bare land,
Yeah.
what are you using it for?
Right. Right.
And when we look at the purchase agreement, they say, oh, yeah, and all the Hawk Climate buildings. We go, oh, okay, well, you A, probably accelerated depreciation on that. So we have a 1245 issue. And B, that's equipment, that's not real estate. So we need to figure out what the value of that portion is. And you will get the funds from that and you will pay the tax on that.
Yeah.
And then all your real estate you can exchange. And so we do a lot of parceling things out. So we're like, we look at a homestead and they say, hey, I've got an 80-acre farm and I live on it. I go, okay, well, you don't technically live on the 80 acres. You live on an acreage that's
Yeah.
like 3 or 4 acres
Yeah,
or
yeah.
whatever it is. Is that parceled out? Have you reported that separately? What's the situation there? Because you can't use your homestead in a 1031 exchange as personal property.
Yeah.
But the rest of the 77 acres is ag land. So you can exchange it. But then we need to figure out what how to do that properly and how to advise clients on the rules of 1031 on how
So
that might apply.
real quick, what Amanda's talking about is there's Homestead Rule 121, which means if you've lived in your property 2 out of any of the last 5 years and you're married and you file your taxes jointly, there's a lot of rules. So talk to your CPA about this. But you can, when you sell, if you've lived in 2 in the last 5 years, you don't pay taxes up to $500,000. So Amanda, what I hear you say is part of that is your personal property residence, which falls under,
The personal property exemption, yep.
and then the rest of it is your ag, is your investment land.
Correct. And yeah, the hard part with ag land is homestead is used as a term for a lot of different things in the Midwest. And so a lot of people just say, oh, yeah, it's the homestead because they have four other farms too that aren't a homestead. They just call that. So there's the East 40 over by like Canton, and then there's the 60 acres over here, the 80 acres over here, and then there's the homestead farm. Which means it's the one they lived on, or it's the one that when the Homesteading Act was passed, their great great grandfathers got as the homestead, and they've kept in the family, and they were the firstborn son of the firstborn son, and they've inherited this land. So they call it the family farm, or they call it the homestead because it's the one they live on. It's not just one that's used specifically for agricultural purposes. Now, as families have gotten out of farming, neighbors buy neighbors' land. And so that's where you get, oh yeah, we own this 80 over here that was my cousin's or my second cousin, but he didn't want it, his kids didn't want a farm, so we bought it. And this one, the neighbors moved, so we bought it. And so it's, yeah, there's a lot of pieces, and that's why we usually have to ask what's on that land and have you lived on it and what's the situation? Because ag land can be just as confusing as commercial, even though it's just land.
So here's a question. So I like this example, 80 acres, but the personal residence sits on, let's just call it 1 acre. 'Cause I can't imagine someone using more than 1 acre, but I live on like a 16th of an acre.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I live on a quarter of an acre. And it's, I can't imagine a farmer living on an acre because they have the barns and stuff too. So that all counts as the part they live on. So normally, if you're driving through the Midwest or if you're driving through different parts of our country, and you're driving through agricultural country, you'll see farms. And then as you drive, it'll be ag land, ag land, ag land. And then there's this little circle of trees. And then in that circle of trees is either parceled out or not the homestead portion, quote unquote. That is the house, the barns, and those wind and those trees are planted as a wind tunnel to help because the plains, especially specifically the rolling plains in the Midwest, have so much wind that a lot of these 100 years ago farmsteads or 200 years ago planted trees in a U shape around three sides of the farm so that the wind wouldn't be so bad where the house and the barns and the garden and things like that.
So,
So that's usually like 3 acres. Yeah.
you touched on this. You touched on this. Do they have to be separate tax IDs? In other words, does the parcel with the home have to be parceled out? And then the parcel with the ranch have to be another parcel to take advantage of the $500,000 rule and then the 1031 rule.
So ideally, yes. 99% of the time they are, because sometime in the past they either parceled them out on purpose for tax purposes, or they bought them in separate parcels or things like that. In the few instances they're not, we have seen people that get a survey done and have them all but functionally separated out. And they say, here's the legal description for the parcel that is that what would be a parcel if it was a parcel. Yeah. For the homestead home section, here's a legal description for the land that is agricultural land.
Yeah. Yeah.
We can do the 1031 so long as we have a legal description of the portion used for the 1031. And then we would use that legal description stating that it's the specific portion of that purchase agreement. But then we also would require on the settlement statement that it shows the two different pieces of property under one larger deed are being sold from party A to party B. But then the settlement statement shows that the client is getting the funds from the homestead because they're not exchangeable.
Yeah.
And so they would get those then, like Spencer said, you would get the personal property exemption of any gain up to $500,000 or higher. And the hard part with some of the agricultural land is they have that gain built in because they were either gifted the land from their dad or their grandfather, or they bought it 75 years ago.
Yeah.
And they bought it for like a dollar an acre.
Yeah.
And now they're selling it for a lot more than that. And so the gain in the ag world is a lot higher, just because ag land has gone up in value a lot. And people have held on to it a lot longer because the use is ag land. Mm-hmm. It's not a commercial building that has like, oh yeah, but it's a 45 or 60 or 75 year old building. We're going to need to tear it down and rebuild it. Or we're going to need to completely gut it and renovate it. It's produced corn and soybeans for hundreds of years. And it's going to continue to do that. And the value of those corn and soybeans has gone up with inflation, things like that. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of gain in the ag world, but how we can exchange it and what you actually want to go into with ag land funds is a different issue as well.
So kind of in the big city, how this principle translates is if someone owns a fourplex, and they've lived in one, let's just say they're four equal units in square footage and everything.
Yep.
And someone lives in one of the units.
Yep.
When they sell that fourplex, they can 1031 exchange
the other three
units worth.
Yep.
And then homestead.
Correct.
One fourth. So that's kind of how.
Yep. And the main thing there, it's actually easier with fourplex than it is with agland. Just because you can say the purchase agreement covers this whole street address.
Sure.
And then we would say in the exchange, units 2, 3, and 4 are being exchanged.
Yeah.
Unit one is being sold just as is from the client.
Yeah.
And then the client's getting, on the settlement statement, it would say sale proceeds from unit one. But the main thing there, especially even on agland, is you have to put a purchase price difference between the two. So that's sometimes the hard part with agriculture, and it can be the hard part with fourplexes. If all the fourplexes are the same two-bedroom, two-bath, or one-bedroom, one-bath, you can say, oh, let's just divide the purchase price by four.
Yeah.
But if one of them is a two-bedroom and one of them is a one-bedroom and one of them is a three-bedroom, you have to look at what portion of that fourplex the value of that unit is.
Yeah.
And then report those three units portion to the exchange and the one unit portion to your personal.
Right.
And similarly with agricultural land, you have to look at, okay, you're selling the 80 acres for X amount. What's the value in that land on the 77 acres versus the 3 acres of the homestead?
Yeah, fascinating.
You have to have that in the purchase. We ideally would have that either in the purchase agreement or in an amendment to the purchase agreement, that the parties are agreeing to the values and that we can go forward knowing that you're selling it for $5 million. $4.5 million of it is ag land. Mm-hmm. $500,000 of it is the homestead portion that has the house and the barns and the equipment and things like that. And you're going to pay the tax on that. And the $4.5 million is going to be invested with the exchange.
So when you've done several, maybe hundreds of these agricultural exchanges over your career as a QI, when someone sits down to sell their ag land, like what advice are you sharing with them as they prepare to list, to accept an offer, to go through the transaction in an effort just to kind of protect their 1031 exchange?
Yeah. So luckily we've worked a lot with a lot of the local tax advisors and legal advisors.
Mm-hmm.
And even the realtors and the brokers and all of them. in some of these small towns that are doing more ag work than some of those bigger cities do. So by the time clients come to us, it's either already set for auction and they know what they're going to doing. They just need to get their QI set up.
Mm-hmm.
But the advice element, we kick back to, we don't give advice. We can tell you the 1031 rules if you have questions. But we don't give tax and legal advice. So as far as accepting an offer and things like that, we say, get a realtor that you trust, get a broker that you trust.
Yeah.
As far as how you want to sell it, talk to the auctioneers, talk to your lawyer probably about how they've been done regionally, because every county, every state is different. Specifically where Sioux Falls is located on the east side of South Dakota. We've got Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota all very close in basically a four-corner situation. And so each state does it differently. Each county does it differently. And they each have different. A million years ago when the glaciers came through, the land is very different. So if I gave the same advice to clients in Iowa that I did in South Dakota, those land values are very different. And what they can accept and what they should accept are very different, just because their produce and their production levels are going to be very different, even 50 miles apart. Because the soil is very different where the Sioux River comes through and things like that. And so as far as advice goes, I would say usually we kick that out to finding good advisors. If you're looking for advice on the 1031, you can call them. We're happy to talk about the rules.
Yeah.
And making sure that you know the rules. Again, we have to go back to the client care. You know the rules. You know what you want to do with it. In the ag perspective, most of the time we're either getting parents that have farmed it their whole lives, and their parents farmed it and their grandparents farmed it, and they either don't have kids or don't have kids that want to farm. So they are going to be moving off of the farm into town. But when they sell the 80 to the neighbor or to their cousin or to whoever it is, they don't know what to do with the money. And they're realizing now that because they owned it their whole lives and it was a gift to them for like $25 80 years ago, their tax advisor has told them they need to call Amanda and they need to figure out a 1031 exchange because they've got a buttload of taxes that they're facing.
Yeah.
And they don't want to pay the government a buttload of taxes.
Yeah.
On land that they had, yes, it's grown in value, but that wasn't the point. They farmed it because they loved farming. And so it's something about their replacement options, figuring out if they want to be a landlord, if they want to have a less hands-on approach, what they want to do long-term. If they have children, what they want to do. If normally it would have been something their children inherited, options that way. Or we have kids that did inherit it. They come to us and go, I've rented it to the neighbor for 10 years. I inherited it. I don't know what to do with it. I really don't want to rent it anymore. The neighbor wants to buy it, but I've had it for 10 years. And even in the 10 years since I got it with my stepped up basis, it's gone up in value enough that I need to do an exchange because my tax advisor told me to call Amanda.
Yeah.
And so I go, okay, we're happy to help. What do you want to do? Do you want to own a fourplex in the town that you live in? Do you want to own a Chipotle and rent it to Chipotle? Do you want to be more hands off and have a national syndicated asset? What are you looking for? And what's the best deal for you? And just giving them their options and letting them go, oh, well, I could do this and I could do that. And that's okay. Well, let's figure out how much money you have from your sale. Let's figure out what you want to do with it. And like I said, that's where you come back to. Some people, they go, oh, I want to go build a new house on this land I bought 4 years ago. And it's like, okay, well, you already own the real estate, so that doesn't work. And you're going to live there, so it still really doesn't work. And you should have done this or called me beforehand. But so it's, that one is interesting because, like I said, we either get the parents or the kids or some element of it doesn't want to be farmed anymore. And what are our options out of ag land? Or they're going, I bought this from my cousin 17 miles away. And, you know, I'm old now, so I don't want to farm that far away. So I'm going to buy my neighbor's parcel. So I'm just going to sell that 80 to buy this 40. And yes, it's less land, but does that work? Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Because it's going up in value. Because the 40 is actually worth more than your other 80 because the land is better.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we get a lot of interesting ad questions, but we do a lot of that.
Amanda, thank you so much for sharing. As we kind of wrap up here, if anyone wants to reach out to you and connect with you, what's a good way they can do that?
Absolutely. So like I had said, I am going on maternity. I am expecting. So I'm going on maternity leave for the month of November, but we do have phenomenal people here in our office. Victoria and Eric are here through the month of November, and then I'll be back December 1st, depending on when I have this baby. But my email is amanda@dakotahomestead.com. And then our number is 605-731-0809. Feel free to call anytime, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 Central. If you are listening to this nationwide, those are the hours for Central time zone. But the email, luckily, is 24/7. I just normally only respond Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. So, yeah, feel free. And Spencer, I appreciate you having me on.
To all of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us. Amanda, thank you. If you feel like a friend, neighbor, loved one could use this info, please share it. Call Amanda with any question, big or small, right?
Any question. We're always happy to help.
Thanks, Amanda. And for everyone, we'll see you next time.